Hello and namaste. I'm Peter Furco, and this is Peter's podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. Chapter 2, Ryoko and Krishna. New York, another 1991. Joseph sat on the steps of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, a gaggle of teenage Japanese girls sporting a cacophony of fashion accessories approached him. One of the girls spoke to him in perfect American English. "Yo, dude, what's your name?" "Joe K. Jones, yo." One of the other girls said something in Japanese and the whole group giggled. The first girl said, "My friend from Tokyo says you're the TV star Joko Jono. We'd know that smile anywhere." Joseph blushed at the attention and stumbled when he needed to ad-lib. "I wish, but I'm Joe, but not Joko," was all he replied. "Dude, you look just like him, though." The other girls were all rattling on in Japanese, but the first girl continued in English. "I'm Ryoko. I'm a TV anchor. Too bad you're not Joko. We could go out and get chased by paparazzi." Joseph felt like a dream was taking place. One minute he's just a bored kid, the next he's considering playing make-believe with attractive playmates. He sat suspended, his eyes downturned from their banter, which in a language he couldn't understand was indistinguishable from their laughter. It felt like they were laughing at him. He stared at the ground and looked for something to say in the flecked stone steps. There wasn't anything there. "Well, at least let us take our picture with you," Ryoko said, and waved at her girlfriends to come and sit around him. She stepped over to the handrail and snapped a photo, the plastic Polaroid spitting out a white image to be. Then she handed the camera to her friend and gave her instructions in Japanese. Ryoko sat next to Joseph and turned, posing a few inches away from kissing him on the cheek. The whirring camera motor pushed out the next picture, and Ryoko fished a pen out of her vinyl knapsack. She handed Joseph the print as it started to develop and said, "Here, autograph, please, to Ryoko, love, Joko." He wrote the name Ryoko assigned him below the photographic ghosts and handed it back. He looked back and forth between the ground and Ryoko. With the game concluded, the girls waved and nodded and giggled their way to the entrance of the Met behind him. Joseph felt depressed at the contrast of his renewed aloneness and walked slowly home, dragging the toes of his Vans on the New York City sidewalk. New York, 1975. Akiko Sato was a professional woman in the model that emerged from 1960s feminism. Her family's Japanese traditions, one generation's worth American, gave her personal experience to rail against. She would not become her mother or her grandmother. She instead held a steady image of herself as an independent operator in the market-driven U.S. of A. She used her beauty as a professional asset, employing it judiciously for effect when it augmented traditional methods. She was not prone to falling in love. Love was not, in her observation, a good step on any career path, except the housewife path she rejected. She rose in one of the few places she saw women succeeding at the level of men, television. Akiko fought first for entry to, then for grades at, then for recommendations from Columbia University School of Journalism. She had one advocate in the program, an assistant dean who saw her equally as the most talented story seeker and the most alluring woman he had ever come across. Akiko held the assistant dean at bay with a skillful mix of judicious flirting and feminist banter. The day she received a job offer from WNBC-TV, she came into his office, locked the door, and announced in feminist banter that she was truly grateful and was going to pay for all his help. He succumbed to her naked flirting as she pulled him to the floor and translated her attentive lovemaking into a fantasy that he had won her. Though she was sweet to him as he pulled away, satiated, he knew in his heart that she had merely taken advantage of him as she had been joking all along. He reminisced fondly about her in his arms until he died on his Cape Cod front porch 20 years later. Akiko's first job was as an off-camera reporter. She excelled at the work. Her on-camera partner took advantage of her skill and efficiency, while he added maturity and judgment to her raw research. She learned quickly and well, and soon her abilities were becoming evident at the daily editorial meetings, first as good questions, then as accurate analysis, then as innovative ideas for angles or follow-up stories. It seemed to the whole team that Akiko was destined to be an excellent reporter. Charles Thornbridge was the news editor. He had begun his career in a more genteel time, but that time ended quickly with the Korean, then Vietnam wars, and their accompanying social unrest, and he became a modern editor. The only remaining habits from his old-school style were calling everybody by last name and smoking cigars, so that entering his office brought either gagging or fond reminiscences of grandfatherly homes. Thornbridge asked Akiko to come into his office. She took a few breaths of fresh office air to brace herself before entering. Despite his age, Thornbridge was a big fan of the Beatles. One of his prized possessions was a photo of himself shaking hands with John Lennon at a peace rally that he had covered. Both were wearing round metal frame glasses and had wavy hair, though Thornbridge's stopped at his earlobe. Akiko was looking at the picture as her editor shut the door and retook his seat. He noticed her face twitch as he picked up the cigar and stuck it in his mouth without lighting it. "Sato, you're a fine reporter. You have great instincts and flawless follow-up. Your writing is excellent, as long as there's a good copy editor available, and you're a team player."
"Thank you, Thornbridge," she replied.
"You're a no-nonsense woman, so I'm going to be no-nonsense with you," he growled past his cigar as he sat back in his chair. He scanned her from the top of her long hair to her navel, where the desk blocked his further view. "Please, by all means," she replied, interrupting the look that she hoped did not mean he was about to propose an affair. "I'm trying to decide whether to give you an on-camera segment. Face it, if you were a white guy, I would have just congratulated you and sent you out the door. But I just want to talk over what this means with you first." Akiko saw that he was not dismissing her outright, and she did admire his candor, so she tried to offset the heat she felt rising by smiling and nodding. "I've got three concerns. First, Sato, and please don't take this as male chauvinism, I just have to wonder, do you plan to stay at this, or are you planning to start and then leave to go have a family?"
"I'm a career woman, sir."
"Because putting your face on air will build a certain identity for the station. I don't want to have that become a waste of time if you leave. Do you know what I mean?"
"Well, yes, I understand. It's possible for anyone to leave, man or woman, of course, but I have no intention of giving up my career to become a housewife, if that's what you're asking, Thornbridge."
"Okay, well, thank you for putting up with that question graciously. I know it's a sore subject in feminist circles."
"Well, having been here for a while, I also see your point of view, sir. Of course, I'd like to see the world improve on that front."
"That ability to see from someone else's perspective is part of what makes you a great reporter, Sato. The other thing I want to know is, how do you think your being a woman will hit our market? I mean, it would be straightforward enough to use you to try to build more audience among women viewers, but that would mean putting you on, well, housewife-friendly stories, human interest and the like. Frankly, I think that would be a waste of your talent. You're the best hard news reporter we've got."
Akiko paused thoughtfully, then replied, "Women are a diverse market. There's a professional segment as well as the housewife segment. If I can speak to those professionals as one of their own, that's a solid draw. Then if I appeal to housewives, it will pull them into news segments they've been ignoring. There may be some kitchen table banter about what I report versus what some male reporter says, but it's possible that controversy could also translate to better market share for the station."
He grunted impatiently, then moved his cigar to the other side of his mouth.
"Do you think you'll come off as credible? Of course I think you're credible, but I know you."
"I think so, Thornbridge. They'll just have to get to know me as you have. I think it will be important to keep it authentic, though. No dumbing it down for the girl, you know?"
"Absolutely."
"And three?"
"What do you mean?"
She smiled, realizing she was demonstrating the thoroughness that had resulted in this interview. "You said you have three concerns."
"Oh, right. It's that you're Japanese. I'm wondering how it will play."
"I think it will work both ways. That's what I always experience with people. First, they expect me to be a foreigner. Then they hear in my lack of an accent that I was born here. From there, they either don't trust me anyway, or they bend over backwards to show that they don't even notice that I'm Japanese."
"Just think of it catches, Sato," he said, half to himself. "We could be the first network with a woman news voice behind the mic, and someone Japanese at that."
"I think John Lennon will approve, Thornbridge."
"All right, then. You've got the job. Let's change the world, Sato."
Akiko Sato enjoyed only a short stint as the special feature reporter on WNBC. Her ratings were bad, despite her fine reporting. Thornbridge kept her feature going for a month after realizing how much viewership dropped, citing the need to build acceptance for something new.
Network management ultimately overruled Thornbridge and had her replaced with a white male. She resigned her job in protest, hoping it would bring some news coverage about sexism in the media. As she was emptying her desk, Thornbridge came by and asked her to go get a cup of coffee. They went to a diner that the staff frequented around the corner. As the waitress set cups and saucers in front of them and poured, Thornbridge took off his round wire frames and put them in his pocket. He leaned back and waited for the waitress to leave the table. "Akiko? First name basis? What's up, Thornbridge? You can't be firing me. I already quit. I feel bad about what happened with your spot. I'm sorry you're leaving the station, but I don't want you to think what I'm about to say is because of those things." "Okay," Akiko replied with a question at the end of the second syllable. He sat up, arms crossed on the edge of the table. "Sato, I want to know if you'll marry me. I'm sorry, Akiko, will you marry me?" he asked. Then he took a sip of his coffee. Akiko fell back in the red vinyl booth with her mouth open. He realized he had to say more. "I admire you tremendously. You're the brightest person I know, and you're passionate about making a difference in the world. I'm not sure if I can say you're beautiful without crossing some feminist line, but you are." He paused a moment and added, "I just had to ask." "Thornbridge, I don't know what to say. I'm so surprised. I just never thought of such a thing." "Of course, I get it. It's okay," he said, and gulped a sip of coffee. She reached over and gingerly took his hand when he set his cup down. "I'm so surprised, in a good way, I mean. But can I think about it for a little while? I need to get used to the idea, Thornbridge. I mean, feel it without the surprise, I mean, and then consider it. I promise I'll let you know soon." He nodded and then grunted. "We should get back to the office." A week later, Akiko invited Thornbridge to join her after work at a bar near the studio. He showed up wearing a tie and sport coat. "A necktie, Thornbridge? I didn't know you knew how to tie one," Akiko said, smiling as they walked to a table. "Yeah, well, it's customary to dress for a funeral." "Is that what this is?" Akiko teased. The waitress showed up immediately. Akiko asked her to come back in a couple minutes. "So I wanted to know if your proposal is still on the table, Thornbridge, or have you thought better of the idea?" He raised an eyebrow in response. "Because I don't need to go on if you've had a new revelation or something."
"No, I stand by my proposal, Sato, foolhardy as it was."
"Okay, Thornbridge. In that case, under three conditions, I provisionally agree to your proposal."
"Really?"
Thornbridge almost shouted, then settled back into his seat.
"What conditions?"
"First, we have to continue to try to change the world."
"What else would we do, Akiko? It's who we are. It's why I love you."
Akiko's hand flew up to her mouth, and she choked up a little before sighing and reaching out to take his hand.
"I like the sound of that. I love you. I do love you, too. You've been so important to me in my work, and I guess my work has been my life to this point. I can't really imagine life without our work, but I guess I'll have to get used to whatever comes."
He smiled. She continued, "And that's the second condition. You have to promise me you won't worry about my work. I can take care of my own career, and I don't want you to make compromises or jeopardize your own career for me." Thornbridge nodded and held back a grin. "But you wouldn't mind working with me, right?" he asked. She nodded at the hypothetical.
"Because I already got approval to use you as a consultant. I didn't want to lose my star reporter."
Akiko smiled and stood to reach across the table to hug him.
"I'm marrying my editor," she laughed and sat back down, leaning forward toward him.
He sat back and crossed his arms.
"Wait a minute. What's the third condition?"
"Oh, right. Well, it's that I get to keep calling you Thornbridge, Charles."
A waitress appeared, and Thornbridge ordered a whiskey.
"Thornbridge, this is a big occasion," Akiko interrupted. "Order some champagne."
New York, 1991. Ryoko Kimura could not wait to leave home, partly to get away from her parents and partly to start on the new life she dreamed of. And so the summer between high school and college, she took a job in New York as the mailroom clerk at WABC-TV. She had left her mother's tears at their home in North Carolina. Her father was, as always, traveling for work, this time representing his employer, Toyota U.S. Manufacturing Division, in trade talks in Washington. Ryoko loved everything about television, from cartoons to period dramas, but as she had progressed through high school, she became very interested in politics, and the news became her obsession. She applied to and was accepted on scholarship to the Columbia University School of Journalism. With her future in telejournalism before her, she enjoyed her part-time job away from her parents and played loose and free-spirited at her temporary home with her aunt in Queens. When in August some relatives came to visit from Japan, Ryoko served as tour guide, leading the entourage around the city sites, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where she teased a boy on the steps with a fantasy straight out of her imagined TV future. When she entered college, Ryoko studied hard in classes, but even more diligently studied Akiko Sato, her faculty advisor, a Japanese-American woman who did investigative research for Network News. Akiko was the toughest professor she had for any class, and Ryoko felt lucky that she had double access to her as an advisor. Akiko took a mutual interest in Ryoko. She asked her to lunch one day during Ryoko's senior year. Ryoko recommended a Japanese restaurant in Hell's Kitchen. "Why'd you want to see me, Professor?" Ryoko asked as the waitress set cups of tea in front of them. The waitress began speaking Japanese, asking what they wanted for lunch. Akiko raised her eyebrows at Ryoko and began to ask the waitress in English for a menu, when Ryoko launched into an animated discussion in Japanese that had the waitress laughing and shouting questions to the cook around the corner. The waitress left and Akiko asked, "Are they going to bring us menus?" "No," Ryoko replied. "They're known for their ramen here, and they just got in some eel off the boat this morning. She said we'd be nuts to have anything else." Akiko nodded approval. "You don't speak Japanese at all?" Ryoko asked. Akiko sighed. "You know, I've spent my whole career trying to have people see me as not," she began. "Not? What do you mean?" Akiko continued, "Not a woman, not too young, not a potential wife, not a baby machine, not just a researcher, not a has-been, and not Japanese." She looked at Ryoko, who was doing her best to understand what this had to do with the ramen order. "I want people to see me as what I am at the core, Ryoko. I'm an American journalist who gets to the heart of an issue and reports the facts, the nuance, the direction, and the likely outcome." "Well, you are that," Ryoko replied, choosing her words cautiously as she had heard the tongue-lashing students could get in class. "I know I am that!" Ryoko jumped at her professor's sudden exclamation. "Look, Kimura, Thornbridge is the only one who ever saw me for what I am." "Thornbridge, your husband, who you talk about in class? You know that. Don't waste time asking unnecessary questions. You know who he is. Get to the root. Ask me why he saw me for what I am, how he did it, when, and most importantly, what he saw." "I presume what he saw was that you are an American journalist who gets..." She was fishing in her memory but jumbled the quote. "That's why you need to ask what. Get it? Sorry. Look, Ryoko, you're a really smart kid with excellent instincts. You have an interest in journalism, not celebrity, and that's rare these days. I see things in you that remind me of myself, but I'm a good enough journalist to know that you're not me. You have opportunities I never had, and you have the talent to take advantage of them." "Wow, thank you, Professor. The question is, will you change the world?" "Change the world? What do you mean?" Ryoko's radiant eyes expressed so much hope that Akiko choked up for a moment. The waitress brought two steaming bowls of broth-covered noodles. She stayed a bit too long telling Ryoko about the ramen, and Ryoko bowed to her and said something in Japanese, then bowed in the direction of Akiko. The waitress bowed to each of them and backed away from the table. "What did you tell her, that I was proposing to you?" Akiko said, having wiped away her earlier tear and mood. "I told her you work for television." "Ha! You're good. But you see, why does she react that way? Television is creating a culture of morons. We watch garbage for hours a day and become impressed by less and less. We are at the point where just the word television gets a reaction like that." "I see what you're saying. Can you explain more about how Mr. Thornbridge saw you for what you are?" "Kimura, if this were a test, you'd get an A. Who, Thornbridge, what, saw me as a journalist, plain and simple. How? He didn't get caught up in the crap. This nation of viewers isn't seeing the essence of information. They're looking at all the irrelevant details. Gender, hair, race. How good-looking is the person on the screen? Is what happened shocking, such as, did someone die? Does an actor freak out? Did a politician have sex? And on until the important things are drowned out and lost." "I'd like to meet your husband," Ryoko said, then added, "Is he changing the world?" "Thornbridge says you can't change the world," she replied, then paused. "But he's definitely trying." When the opportunity arose at a university event, Akiko introduced Ryoko to Thornbridge. She asked him about his work, and he told her about the difference between what passes for good and true excellence. "It's like living for the highest version of things, not taking the easy way. doesn't matter if you're completing a simple fact check or writing the headline for a major event, Thornbridge said, grinding between his teeth the cigar that most public places no longer allowed him to light. I hope to write major headlines someday, Ryoko said. Don't miss the point, Akiko corrected. Excellence is doing everything like it makes a difference. That's all that matters.
Get it? Thornbridge asked.
She nodded. That's what changes the world, right, sir? Thornbridge grunted. Ryoko looked at her mentor, who was smiling. Ryoko had always been a bit of a flirt, and at the end of senior year, Akiko noticed her trailing a collection of boys when she showed up to have coffee, chat about her paper, or do some work. Not long after Ryoko had met Thornbridge, the mentor and student were at a cafe near Akiko's subway station. Akiko touched on a topic that had been central in her own career. Are you planning to get married? She started.
I guess I hadn't really thought about it.
Because you seem to pay a lot of attention to guys.
Well, they're kind of hard to ignore, like puppies following you around and rolling over for a belly rub.
I envy your lack of disdain for men, but I guess things are so much different now than when I was starting my career.
But you have an awesome husband and all these admiring students. You've never really told me about when you were first working at the station. What was different then?
Akiko described the 70s newsroom and told Ryoko the details of her ill-fated run on camera.
When I was your age, men looked at a woman and saw one thing.
Sex, Ryoko responded with a knowing nod.
Well, two things. That, but more importantly, someone who stayed home and raised kids. A career woman was almost unknown.
But I thought the feminist movement changed all that in the 60s.
The movement only brought the problem into the light. The women who tried to break out of the work to bride to housewife mold were seen as a threat, or at least as weirdos. You had to be willing to face rolling eyes and jokes behind your back if you were going to toe the feminist line.
Did you toe the line?
I did. I avoided men like they were going to taint my resolve. They avoided me like I was going to bite their heads off.
But you got married.
I married the man who saw me for what I was and respected me as a career woman first. I guess that's the difference now. Most women stay in careers even when they take on family and home.
Ryoko was quiet for half a minute, processing her mentor's story. Then she looked up at Akiko.
I think things are more the same than you're saying, because some of the girls I know who are bent on getting married talk about their careers as a way to meet the right guy. And even just trying to go out with someone makes for challenges at school. I'm always trying to figure out how to get my work done while some guy's telling me to blow it off and drink some beers or go to a party.
Well, I think guys get intimidated by smart women. That's been a feminist mantra since the 60s.
The difference now is there are more guys who are used to seeing smart women and career women, so they're more like Thornbridge.
I still crack up every time I hear you call him Thornbridge, Ryoko said, and they both laughed and sipped coffee.
Are any of these puppies I see following you serious threats to your career?
I'm not sure any of them are even graduating.
So you're free to go change the world?
Ready and willing, sir.
Because, Akiko began slowly, holding down an emerging smile, Thornbridge says the state news editor is looking for a reporter.
What?
He wondered if I thought you were able to hand it with your class workload and social life.
Social life? I don't have a social life.
That's why the question about the puppy boys.
Professor, I really want to do this. Do you mean it? How do I apply?
He already told the editor you'd be perfect. You can start Monday morning if you want.
If I want? Ryoko jumped across the table and hugged Akiko, then kissed her on one cheek.
Careful, Ryoko. Back in the day, they would have said, those two career women are lesbians.
New York, 1978. Joseph K. Jones, whom his mother's paramour called Le Petit Jacot, stumbled upon his mother in her lover's arms three times before asking whether Rusty was going to live with her and Daddy in their bedroom. While the five-year-old's question was simple, Janet Jones realized the bigger implication. She told Joseph to go get a popsicle, sent Rusty home, and called her best girlfriend. That evening, she went into her husband's study, her platinum hair, a splash of layered curls spilling over her suede mini-dress.
I'm moving with Rusty to Paris, she said, chin held high.
Joseph Archibald Jones, the poet, pulled his pen from the page and leaned back in his chair, interrupting a line inspired by Rusty and a teenage girl, and looked into Janet's eyes.
He turned back to his page and wrote the words, "And freedom left to children." Archie Jones, the husband, looked away from his wife, out the window of their Upper East Side apartment. This moment had been coming for as long as he could remember, but the fact of it stung nonetheless. He goaded her. "I guess you'll want Joseph to be stuck away in some boarding school." "Why can't he live here with you?" she asked, not taking the bait. "He belongs with his mother." He paused for a beat before adding in meter, "who won't live with Dad." He sneered, adding, "Or perhaps Rusty is father material. He has surely had enough experience producing children." The last line was bitter, and Archie washed it down with the gin and tonic that sat half full on his desk. "You know as well as I do that Rusty doesn't have children. Anyway, I could take Joseph, but he just started school here, and he has friends. I hate to pull him away from that." Archie wanted his namesake to stay as much as he wanted to hurt his wife. "You're such a child to think choosing Rusty is freedom. He's just a dream." He debated with himself for a split second that felt like an eternity to both of them. Then he hit below the belt. "You would be the kind of mother who could leave a son behind. Total narcissist. I bet Rusty told you to leave him. You two and your stupid hippie bullshit." Archie wanted to keep his son near, but he had chosen otherwise. Janet barely spoke to him over the next 2 weeks as she cleared out, packed Joseph up, and took him with her to meet Rusty in Paris, where he was setting up an apartment for them. Albany, another 2001. Bored with her state news beat in Albany, Ryoko Kimura took a month off. While her editor was unhappy, Ryoko had vacation time coming. She told the editor she was interested in doing a special interest piece during her holiday, hoping it would appease him. The editor was swayed with that sweetener in the pot, and even though she couldn't say what the category of story would be, he trusted that with her instincts, it would be good news. She hadn't been sure she could get the time, and so had avoided planning a specific trip. Once she had approval, she considered several options before deciding to go to France. The vacation would be time spent in Paris and its suburbs, the story she would give time to emerge. Perhaps something about Muslim culture or French-style political coverage, something far from her New York state beat. She found an inexpensive hotel in a less chic arrondissement of Paris to serve as a base and took somewhat arbitrary trips from there, following a news story from the papers or just getting on a train and getting off when the spirit moved her. One morning in a cafe near her hotel, she overheard an American talking and a lot of laughing. Ryoko turned and saw a man about her own age with a stunning smile slouching over the table, speaking to a couple of young guys and an older bearded man wearing what looked like a fishing vest. They were all looking down at a long piece of paper that was folded like an accordion on both ends. When the waiter approached their table, the smiling one flipped into perfect French and asked for another round of coffee for the table. The bearded man interrupted in English that he would have a beer. The waiter promptly scooted away. Ryoko traced the owner of the stunning smile's long frame in black button-down shirt and black jeans as he gesticulated and exclaimed, all with an exaggerated hush that made it impossible for Ryoko to hear what he was describing. His compatriots burst out laughing. The older bearded man fell back in his chair, bumping against a Frenchwoman in a sailor-striped shirt. She turned and glared at him as he adjusted his chair and twisted around to apologize. Ryoko's radar for a good story signaled a go. She walked over to the table and cleared her throat. "Excuse me. Hi. I'm Ryoko. I'm a reporter from New York." The handsome man stood up, playing to the table. "I'm Jocko Jones, a film director in Paris." One of the young men, whose blonde hair looked like it was styled in a wind tunnel, had been pointing a camera with a zoom lens at Jocko and widened the angle to include Ryoko. Jocko added, "I think we can escape the paparazzi in my penthouse." The guys around the table laughed anew at this scene. The sailor-striped woman folded her book emphatically, got up, and left the cafe. Ryoko asked if she could join them. Jocko nodded, and the bearded man pulled over the newly vacant seat from behind him. The waiter dropped off the drinks and brought Ryoko's tea to their table. "What brings you to Paris? Ryoko, is it?" the bearded man asked in a thick accent that was not French. "I'm vacationing, but I only convinced my boss to give me the time off by saying I'd bring him back a story. You gentlemen seem to be doing something interesting." Ryoko was beautiful, and Jocko was as reluctant to let her leave as he was to tell her about his project. He stalled. Lukasz is the one you should talk to. He's a very well-respected cineast from Poland. He worked with Krzysztof Kieslowski.
Well, that's very impressive. I don't really know his work, but great. What are you working on now?
Lukasz set down the bottle he had just emptied and barely concealed a burp.
Oh, now I'm working on the dog movie with this genius.
He wiggled the empty bottle at the waiter across the cafe.
Not much of a stall, Jocko thought, and covered.
This has to all be off the record, because we're just getting underway.
Oh, sure, Ryoko nodded. Maybe there's a way I could do a little piece on some aspect of what you're doing.
I don't want to get in your way. In fact, I don't even know what you're doing. A dog movie? Is it for a nature show? The group laughed. Jocko shifted in his chair.
Look, I'm happy to talk with you about it more, but right now I have all this high-priced talent in a production meeting.
The young guy snickered. The darker-haired one asked the other something in a language Ryoko couldn't identify, then punched him in the arm.
How about you meet me for a drink tonight? If you're interested in the project, you can come to the set tomorrow.
A drink in your penthouse? Ryoko asked, trying with her tone to establish that she was not someone to be toyed with.
No, here's better, he answered. It turns into more of a bar later. Say, 8 p.m.?
Ryoko agreed. Okay, see you at 8. 8 o'clock came and went as Ryoko sat at a sidewalk table sipping Campari and soda. She smiled off a share of catcalls from young boys on mobilette and evoked more than one turned head from a passing debonair Frenchman. A man at the bar sent her a drink. She nodded in appreciation and he came to her table. She told him she was waiting for someone to discuss business, but he was late, and she wondered if he forgot.
Is he French? Guillaume asked.
American, but I think he lives here. He speaks fluent French.
Well, maybe he is on French time. We are loser.
Loser? Ryoko asked.
Not so tight on the schedule, he clarified,
and she realized he meant looser.
Right. What do you do, Guillaume?
Me, I am a gigolo.
You have this word in English?
Gigolo? Yeah, but it means a prostitute. Are you propositioning me?
Her body shifted in the chair.
Oh, wait, no, yeah, the word does mean that, but no, I mean to be funny with you. I say I'm like Cary Grant. Smooth, you know?
Oh, you mean you're debonair. Wait, that's a French word, isn't it?
Oui, yes, I guess that's a good word if it's in English too.
But I mean, what kind of work do you do? What's your profession?
Oh, you Americans, so concerned about working. You live to work. We work, but mostly we live.
But when you work, what do you do?
I am an administrator in the city. I run the bureau that is in charge of Le Metro.
Really? Interesting. I'm a TV reporter.
Oh, vraiment? Do I know you from the TV shows? I read American magazines sometime, you know.
Probably not, but I report on state government in New York, topics like our subway, Metro.
Oh, I love New York. I was there 5 years ago. So much excitement.
Well, I'm in Albany mostly, the state capital.
Jocko tapped Ryoko on the shoulder. She turned and smiled, then introduced him to Guillaume.
Yes, I know Guillaume, Jocko said dryly.
Ça va?
Très bien, Joseph.
You did not say to me you wait for Joseph. I can tell you, he is toujours en retard.
Fashionably late, Americans say, Jocko clarified. I hope Guillaume has kept you entertained with stories of the subway and how hard he makes it for filmmakers to get permits to shoot there.
I have to keep my boss happy, but I bend every rule for this guy.
I thought you said you run the bureau, Ryoko replied.
Ah, you are one of those tough reporters that makes us hot, Guillaume sputtered out.
I think you mean makes us sweat, mon ami. Don't you have some paperwork you need to finish for tomorrow?
Jocko asked as he pulled over a chair from a table he'd just vacated.
Not when there are such beautiful things to live for in the café. But I know you have to talk business, so I will depart. Enchanté de faire votre connaissance, Ryoko.
Guillaume walked to the bar and introduced himself to a tall redhead.
Is he really the head of a city agency? Ryoko asked. New York bureaucrats are more like computer simulations than characters from Bogart movies.
I don't know. Koch and Giuliani are pretty comical.
You know New York politics?
I'm from New York, and my dad still lives there, so I hear the highlights of what's going on.
Guillaume called you Joseph.
Yeah, that's my given name. He knows me from my applications for filming permits.
How'd you get the nickname? She asked, more in the tone of a date than a reporter.
He noticed the tone and sat back and smiled at her.
My mom's boyfriend, Rusty, had a friend, Benoit Jacquot. Maybe you've heard of him?
Ryoko shook her head. He's a director. Anyway, Rusty always called me the Little Jacko, which is also a French nickname for Joseph, and the name stuck. The waiter brought them two glasses of wine sent by Guillaume. They toasted in his direction. Ryoko switched gears toward her story. What's this movie you're working on? Sounds like it's a highlight around here. Off the record, then I'll figure out what you can cover, okay?
Sure. It's about a dog?
Not exactly. Jacko sat forward in his chair. He had to decide between his elevator speech version, his paragraph-long blurb, or the long form.
Do you like movies?
Sure, I love movies. I used to watch a lot on TV when I was growing up. I have to admit, I fell off following movies when I became so involved in the news. Well, I hate most movies, at least American movies. Rusty was a struggling director. He introduced me to French cinema, so I got spoiled. I studied cinema and video art in Paris, and one of my fellow students, Julie, was cast in a Kieślowski film. I had a crush on her, so I learned all I could about him and ended up falling in love with his directing.
And not the girl?
No, that didn't come to pass, though she is interested. Kieślowski's the director Lukasz worked with.
Hey, you're good.
Yeah, so he had written these screenplays based on the Ten Commandments for TV. We get horny divorcees of Denver and they get biblical allegory. Isn't that like Christian TV?
No. Well, most Poles are Catholic, but these stories use the commandments like fables to explore the ethical issues modern Poland was facing.
Interesting. So you make movies now, not art video.
Yeah, I saw how powerful the medium could be when used artfully, so I enrolled in film school in Łódź, the academy Kieślowski studied at.
In Poland? Do you speak Polish?
Now a little, but everyone speaks some English, and we're dealing with film, which transcends language if you do it right.
And species, too, it sounds like, because now you're doing the dog film.
What is it really called?
The Man Who Could Talk to Dogs.
Well, I see why everyone's calling it the dog film. Can you give me a synopsis?
Jacko never dreamed a reporter could be so intelligent, and the fact that she was so interested in his film was thrilling. Combined with her appearance, that interest was also arousing. He told her the plot of his movie. In fact, he almost recited the script. He ordered a second round of drinks at the end of the second act and a third before reaching the finale.
That is utterly fabulous, Jacko. I can't wait to see this. I can't wait to hear the characters in the painting. That alone would be worth the admission.
I hope every critic is as smart and insightful as you are. He dropped his hand onto hers on the small cafe table. Her reflex to pull away was countered by an equally strong urge to continue experiencing his touch. Jacko called the waiter and paid the bill. He ushered Ryoko the several blocks to his flat and directed her into his bedroom. Over the next few weeks, they performed a rendition of Transitory Love that brought relevance to the classic story that bored him in American movies.
That's it for today's excerpt. You can hear more later on in Peter's podcast. Or if you just can't wait, head over to Amazon.com where you can find Incarnation. Thanks.